its empire, or Austria helping itself to the odd Balkan nation. Zero is also the number of times that any country has conquered even parts of some other country since 1975, and it is not far from the number of permanent conquests since 1948, a development we'll soon examine more closely. In fact, the process of great power aggrandizement went into reverse. In what has been called the greatest transfer of power in world history, European countries surrendered vast swaths of territory as they closed down their empires and granted independence to colonies, sometimes peacefully, sometimes because they had lost the will to prevail in colonial wars. As we will see in the next chapter, two entire categories of war, the imperial war to acquire colonies and the colonial war to keep them, no longer exist. Zero is the number of internationally recognized states since World War II that have gone out of existence through conquest. South Vietnam may be the exception, depending on whether its unification with North Vietnam in 1975 is counted as a conquest or as the end of an internationalized civil war. During the first half of the 20th century, by comparison, 22 states were occupied or absorbed at a time when the world had far fewer states to begin with. Though scores of nations have gained independence since 1945, and several have broken apart, most of the lines on a world map of 1950 are still present on a world map in 2010. This, too, is an extraordinary development in a world in which rulers used to treat imperial expansion as part of their job description. The point of this chapter is that these zeros, the long peace, are a result of one of those psychological retunings that take place now and again over the course of history and cause violence to decline. In this case, it is a change within the mainstream of the developed world, and increasingly the rest of the world, in the shared cognitive categorization of war. For most of human history, influential people who craved power, prestige, or vengeance could count on their political network to ratify those cravings and to turn off their sympathies for the victims of an effort to satisfy them. They believed, in other words, in the legitimacy of war. Though the psychological components of war have not gone away, dominance, vengeance, callousness, tribalism, groupthink, self-deception, since the late 1940s, they have been disaggregated in Europe and other developed countries in a way that has driven down the frequency of war. Some people downplay these stunning developments by pointing out that wars still take place in the developing world, so perhaps violence has only been displaced, not reduced. In the following chapter, we will examine armed conflict in the rest of the world, but for now, it's worth noting that the objection makes little sense. There is no law of conservation of violence, no hydraulic system in which a compression of violence in one part of the world forces it to bulge out somewhere else. Tribal, civil, private, slave raiding, imperial, and colonial wars have inflamed the territories of the developing world for millennia. A world in which war continues in some of the poorer countries is still better than a world in which it takes place in both the rich and the poor countries, especially given the incalculably greater damage that rich, powerful countries can wreak. A long peace, to be sure, is not a perpetual peace. No one with a statistical appreciation of history could possibly say that a war between great powers, developed countries, or European states will never happen again. But probabilities can change over spans of time that matter to us. The house odds on the iron dice can decline. The power law line can sink or tilt, and in much of the world, that appears to have happened. The same statistical consciousness, though, alerts us to alternative possibilities. Perhaps the odds haven't changed at all, and we're overinterpreting a random run of peaceful years in the same way that we are liable to overinterpret a random cluster of wars or atrocities. Perhaps the pressure for war has been building, and the system will blow at any moment. But probably not. The statistics of deadly quarrels show that war is not a pendulum, a pressure cooker, or a hurtling mass, but a memoryless game of dice, perhaps one with changing odds. And the history of many nations affirms that a peace among them can last indefinitely. As Muller puts it, if war fever were cyclical, one would expect the Swiss, Danes, Swedes, Dutch, and Spaniards to be positively roaring for a fight by now. Nor are Canadians and Americans losing sleep about an overdue invasion across the world's longest undefended border. What about the possibility of a run of good luck? Also unlikely. The post-war years are by far the longest period of peace among great powers since they came into being 500 years ago. The stretch of peace among European states is also the longest in its bellicose history. Just about any statistical test can confirm that the zeros and near zeros of the long peace are extremely improbable, given the rates of war in the preceding centuries. Taking the frequency of wars between great powers from 1495 to 1945 as a baseline, the chance that there would be a 65-year stretch with only a single great power war, the marginal case of the Korean War, is 1 in 1,000. Even if we take 1815 as our starting point, which biases the test against us by letting the peaceful post-Napoleonic 19th century dominate the base rate, we find that the probability that the post-war era would have at most 4 wars involving a great power is less than 0.004, and the probability that it would have at most 1 war between European states, the Soviet invasion of Hungary in 1956, is 0.0008. The calculation of probabilities, to be sure, critically depends on how one defines the events. Odds are very different when you estimate them in a full knowledge of what happened, a post hoc comparison, also known as data snooping, and when you lay down your prediction beforehand, a planned or a priori comparison. Recall that the chance that 2 people in a room of 57 will share a birthday is 99 out of 100. In that case, we are specifying the exact day only after we identify the pair of people. The chance that someone will share my birthday is less than 1 in 7. In that case, we specify the day beforehand. A stock scammer can exploit the distinction by sending out newsletters with every possible prediction about the trajectory of the market. Several months later, the fraction of recipients that got the lucky matching run will think he is a genius. A skeptic of the long peace could claim that anyone making a big deal of a long run of non-wars at the end of that very run is just as guilty of data snooping. But in fact, there is a paper trail of scholars who, more than 2 decades ago, noticed that the war-free years were piling up and attributed it to a new mindset that they expected to last. Today we can say that their a priori predictions have been confirmed. The story can be told in titles and dates. Werner Levy's The Coming End of War, 1981. John Gaddis's The Long Peace, Elements of Stability in the Post-War International System, 1986. Kalevi Holsti's The Horseman of the Apocalypse, At the Gate, Detoured, or Retreating, 1986. Evan Luard's The Blunted Sword, The Erosion of Military Power in Modern World Politics, 1988. John Mueller's Retreat from Doomsday, The Obsolescence of Major War, 1989. Francis Fukuyama's The End of History, 1989. James Lee Ray's The Abolition of Slavery and the End of International War, 1989. And Carl Kaysen's Is War Obsolete, 1990. In 1988, the political scientist Robert Jervis captured the phenomenon they were all noticing. The most striking characteristic of the post-war period is just that. It can be called post-war because the major powers have not fought each other since 1945. Such a lengthy period of peace among the most powerful states is unprecedented. These scholars were confident that they were not being fooled by a lucky run, but were putting their finger on an underlying shift that supported predictions about the future. In early 1990, Kaysen added a last-minute postscript to his review of Mueller's 1989 book, in which he wrote, "It is clear that a profound transformation of the international structure in Europe and the whole world is underway. In the past, such changes have regularly been consummated by war. The argument presented in this essay supports the prediction that this time the changes can take place without war, although not necessarily without domestic violence in the states concerned. So far, mid-January, so good." The author and his readers will be eagerly and anxiously testing the prediction each day. Precocious assessments of the obsolescence of interstate war are especially poignant when they come from military historians. These are the scholars who have spent their lives immersed in the annals of warfare and should be most jaded about the possibility that this time it's different. In his magnum opus, A History of Warfare, John Keegan, the military historian who is so habitually called distinguished that one could be forgiven for thinking it is part of his name, wrote in 1993, "War, it seems to me, after a lifetime of reading about the subject, mingling with men of war, visiting the sites of war and observing its effects, may well be ceasing to commend itself to human beings as a desirable or productive, let alone rational, means of reconciling their discontents." The equally distinguished Michael Howard had already written in 1991, "It has become quite possible that war in the sense of major organized armed conflict between highly developed societies may not recur, and that a stable framework for international order will become firmly established." And the no less distinguished Evan Luard, Our Guide to 6 Centuries of War, had written still earlier, in 1986, "Most startling of all has been the change that has come about in Europe, where there has been a virtual cessation of international warfare. Given the scale and frequency of war during the preceding centuries in Europe, this is a change of spectacular proportions, perhaps the single most striking discontinuity that the history of warfare has anywhere provided." More than 2 decades later, none of them would have a reason to change his assessment. In his 2006 book, War and Human Civilization, A Military History That Is More Sweeping Than Its Predecessors and Salted with the Hobbesian Realism of Evolutionary Psychology, Azar Ghat wrote, "Among affluent liberal democracies, a true state of peace appears to have developed, based on genuine mutual confidence that war between them is practically eliminated even as an option. Nothing like this had ever existed in history." The Long Peace: Attitudes and Events. The emphasis in Ghat's true state of peace highlights not just the datum that the number of wars between developed states happens to be zero, but a change in the country's mindsets. The ways that developed countries conceptualize and prepare for war have undergone sweeping changes. A major feeder of the increasing deadliness of war since 1500 has been conscription, the stocking of national armies with a renewable supply of bodies. By the time of the Napoleonic Wars, most European countries had some form of a draft. Conscientious objection was barely a concept, and recruitment methods were far less polite than the telegram dreaded by young American men in the 1960s that began, "Greetings." The idiom, "pressed into service," comes from the institution of press gangs, groups of goons paid by the government to snatch men from the streets and force them into the army or navy. The Continental Navy during the American Revolutionary War was almost entirely rounded up by press gangs. Compulsory military service could consume a substantial portion of a man's life, as much as 25 years for a serf in 19th century Russia. Military conscription represents the application of force squared. People are coerced into servitude, and the servitude exposes them to high odds of being maimed or killed. Other than at times of existential threat, the extent of conscription is a barometer of a country's willingness to sanction the use of force. In the decades after World War II, the world saw a steady reduction in the length of compulsory military service. The United States, Canada, and most European countries have eliminated conscription outright, and in the others, it functions more as a citizenship-building exercise than as a training ground for warriors. Payne has compiled statistics on the length of military conscription between 1970 and 2000 in 48 long-established nations, which I have updated for 2010. They show that conscription was in decline even before the end of the Cold War in the late 1980s. Only 19% of these countries did without conscription in 1970. The proportion rose to 35% in 2000 and to 50% in 2010, and it will soon exceed 50% because at least two other countries, Poland and Serbia, plan to abolish the draft in the early 2010s. Another indicator of war friendliness is the size of a nation's military forces as a proportion of its population, whether enlisted by conscription or by television ads promising volunteers that they can be all that they can be. Payne has shown that the proportion of the population that a nation puts in uniform is the best indicator of its ideological embrace of militarism. When the United States demobilized after World War II, it took on a new enemy in the Cold War and never shrank its military back to pre-war levels. But the trend since the mid-1950s has been sharply downward. Europe's disinvestment of human capital in the military sector began even earlier. Other large countries, including Australia, Brazil, Canada, and China, also shrank their armed forces during this half-century. After the Cold War ended, the trend went global. From a peak of more than 9 military personnel per 100,000 people in 1988, the average across long-established countries plunged to less than 5.5 in 2001. Some of these savings have come from outsourcing non-combat functions like laundry and food services to private contractors, and in the wealthiest countries, from replacing frontline military personnel with robots and drones. But the age of robotic warfare is far in the future, and recent events have shown that the number of available boots on the ground is still a major constraint on the projection of military force. For that matter, the roboticizing of the military is itself a manifestation of the trend we are exploring. Countries have developed these technologies at a fantastic expense because the lives of their citizens, and as we shall see, of foreign citizens, have become dearer. Since wars begin in the minds of men, it is in the minds of men that the defenses of peace must be constructed. UNESCO motto. Another indication that the long peace is no accident is a set of sanity checks which confirm that the mentality of leaders and populaces has changed. Each component of the war-friendly mindset, nationalism, territorial ambition, an international culture of honor, popular acceptance of war, and indifference to its human costs, went out of fashion in developed countries in the second half of the 20th century. The first signal event was the 1948 endorsement of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by 48 countries. The declaration begins with these articles. Article 1. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. Article 2. Everyone is entitled to all the rights and freedoms set forth in this declaration, without distinction of any kind, such as race, color, sex, language, religion, political or other opinion, national or social origin, property, birth, or other status. Furthermore, no distinction shall be made on the basis of the political, jurisdictional, or institutional status of the country or territory to which a person belongs, whether it be independent, trust, non-self-governing, or under any other limitation of sovereignty. Article 3. Everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of person. It's tempting to dismiss this manifesto as feel-good verbiage. But in endorsing the Enlightenment ideal that the ultimate value in the political realm is the individual human being, The signatories were repudiating a doctrine that had reigned for more than a century, namely, that the ultimate value was the nation, people, culture, folk, class, or other collectivity, to say nothing of the doctrine of earlier centuries that the ultimate value was the monarch and the people were his or her chattel. The need for an assertion of universal human rights had become evident during the Nuremberg trials of 1945 through 46, when some lawyers had argued that Nazis could be prosecuted only for the portion of the genocides they committed in occupied countries like Poland. What they did on their own territory, according to the earlier way of thinking, was none of anyone else's business. Another sign that the declaration was more than hot air was that the great powers were nervous about signing it. Britain was worried about its colonies, the United States about its Negroes, and the Soviet Union about its puppet states. But after Eleanor Roosevelt shepherded the declaration through 83 meetings, it passed without opposition, though pointedly with 8 abstentions from the Soviet bloc. The era's repudiation of counter-Enlightenment ideology was made explicit 45 years later by Václav Havel, the playwright who became president of Czechoslovakia after the non-violent Velvet Revolution had overthrown the communist government. Havel wrote, "The greatness of the idea of European integration on democratic foundations is its capacity to overcome the old Herderian idea of the nation-state as the highest expression of national life." One paradoxical contributor to the long peace was the freezing of national borders. The United Nations initiated a norm that existing states and their borders were sacrosanct. By demonizing any attempt to change them by force as aggression, the new understanding took territorial expansion off the table as a legitimate move in the game of international relations. The borders may have made little sense, the governments within them may not have deserved to govern, but rationalizing the borders by violence was no longer a live option in the minds of statesmen. The grandfathering of boundaries has been, on average, a pacifying development because, as the political scientist John Vasquez has noted, of all the issues over which wars could logically be fought, territorial issues seem to be the one most often associated with wars. Few interstate wars are fought without any territorial issue being involved in one way or another. The political scientist Mark Zucker has quantified the change. Since 1951, there have been only 10 invasions that resulted in a major change in national boundaries, all before 1975. Many of them planted flags in sparsely populated hinterlands and islands, and some carved out new political entities, such as Bangladesh, rather than expanding the territory of the conqueror. 10 may sound like a lot, but it represents a precipitous drop from the preceding 3 centuries. Israel is an exception that proves the rule. The serpentine Green Line, where the Israeli and Arab armies stopped in 1949, was not particularly acceptable to anyone at the time, especially the Arab states. But in the ensuing decades, it took on an almost mystical status in the international community as Israel's one true correct border. The country has acceded to international pressure to relinquish most of the territory it has occupied in the various wars since then, and within our lifetimes it will probably withdraw from the rest, with some minor swaps of land, and perhaps a complicated arrangement regarding Jerusalem, where the norm of immovable borders will clash with the norm of undivided cities. Most other conquests, such as the Indonesian takeover of East Timor, have been reversed as well. The most dramatic recent example was in 1990, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, the only time since 1945 that one member of the UN has swallowed another one whole, and an aghast multinational coalition made short work of pushing him out. The psychology behind the sanctity of national boundaries is not so much empathy or moral reasoning as norms and taboos, a topic that will be explored in Chapter 9. Among respectable countries, conquest is no longer a thinkable option. A politician in a democracy today who suggested conquering another country would be met not with counterarguments, but with puzzlement embarrassment, or laughter. The territorial integrity norm, Zucker points out, has ruled out not just conquest, but other kinds of boundary tinkering. During decolonization, the borders of newly independent states were the lines that some imperial administrator had drawn on a map decades before, often bisecting ethnic homelands or throwing together enemy tribes. Nonetheless, there was no movement to get all the new leaders to sit around a table with a blank map and a pencil and redraw the borders from scratch. The breakup of the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia also resulted in the dashed lines between internal republics and provinces turning into solid lines between sovereign states without any redrafting. The sacralization of arbitrary lines on a map may seem illogical, but there is a rationale to the respecting of norms, even arbitrary and unjustifiable ones. The game theorist Thomas Schelling has noted that when a range of compromises would leave two negotiators better off than they would be if they walked away, any salient cognitive landmark can lure them into an agreement that benefits them both. People bargaining over a price, for example, can get to yes by splitting the difference between their offers, or by settling on a round number rather than haggling indefinitely over the fairest price. Melville Swaler's in Moby Dick acceded to the norm that fast fish belongs to the party fast to it because they knew it would avoid the most vexatious and violent disputes. Lawyers say that possession is 9/10 of the law, and everyone knows that good fences make good neighbors. A respect for the territorial integrity norm ensures that the kind of discussion that European leaders had with Hitler in the 1930s, when it was considered perfectly reasonable that he should swallow Austria and chunks of Czechoslovakia to make the borders of Germany coincide with the distribution of ethnic Germans, is no longer thinkable. Indeed, the norm has been corroding the ideal of the nation-state and its sister principle of the self-determination of peoples, which obsessed national leaders in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The goal of drawing a smoother border through the fractal of interpenetrating ethnic groups is an unsolvable geometry problem, and living with existing borders is now considered better than endless attempts to square the circle, with its invitations to ethnic cleansing and irredentist conquest. The territorial integrity norm brings with it numerous injustices, as ethnic groups may find themselves submerged in political entities that have no benevolent interest in their welfare. The point was not lost on Ishmael, who mused, "What do that redoubted harpooner John Bull is poor Ireland but a fast fish?" Some of Europe's peaceful borders demarcate countries that were conveniently homogenized by the massive ethnic cleansing of World War II and its aftermath, when millions of ethnic Germans and Slavs were forcibly uprooted from their homes. The developing world is now being held to higher standards, and it is likely, as the sociologist Anne Hironaka has argued, that its civil wars have been prolonged by the insistence that states always be preserved and borders never altered. But on balance, the sacred border norm appears to have been a good bargain for the world. As we shall see in the next chapter, the death toll from a large number of small civil wars is lower than that from a few big interstate wars, to say nothing of world wars, consistent with the power law distribution of deadly quarrels. And even civil wars have become fewer in number and less damaging as the modern state evolves from a repository for the national soul to a multi-ethnic social contract conforming to the principle of human rights. Together with nationalism and conquest, another ideal has faded in the post-war decades: honor. As Luard understands it, in general, the value placed on human life today is probably higher, and that placed on national prestige or honor probably lower than in earlier times. Nikita Khrushchev, the leader of the Soviet Union during the worst years of the Cold War, captured the new sensibility when he said, "I'm not some czarist officer who has to kill himself if I fart at a masked ball. It's better to back down than go to war." Many national leaders agree, and have backed down or held their fire in response to provocations that in previous eras would have incited them to war. In 1979, the United States responded to two affronts in quick succession, the Russian invasion of Afghanistan and the government-indulged takeover of the American embassy in Iran, with little more than an Olympic boycott and a nightly televised vigil. As Jimmy Carter said later, "I could have destroyed Iran with my weaponry, but I felt in the process it was likely that the hostages' lives would be lost, and I didn't want to kill 20,000 Iranians, so I didn't attack." Though American hawks were furious at Carter's wimpiness, their own hero, Ronald Reagan, responded to a 1983 bombing that killed 241 American servicemen in Beirut by withdrawing all American forces from the country. And he sat tight in 1987 when Iraqi jet fighters killed 37 sailors on the USS Stark. The 2004 train bombing in Madrid by an Islamist terrorist group, far from whipping the Spanish into an anti-Islamic lather, prompted them to vote out the government that had involved them in the Iraq War, an involvement many felt had brought the attack upon them. The most consequential discounting of honor in the history of the world was the resolution of the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. Though the pursuit of national prestige may have precipitated the crisis, once Khrushchev and Kennedy were in it, they reflected on their mutual need to save face and set that up as a problem for the two of them to solve. Kennedy had read Tuchman's The Guns of August, A History of World War I, and knew that an international game of chicken, driven by personal complexes of inferiority and grandeur, could lead to a cataclysm. Robert Kennedy, in a memoir on the crisis, recalled, "Neither side wanted war over Cuba, we agreed. But it was possible that either side could take a step that, for reasons of security or pride or face, would require a response by the other side, which in turn, for the same reasons of security, pride, or face, would bring about a counter-response and eventually an escalation into armed conflict. That was what he wanted to avoid." Khrushchev's wisecrack about the Tsarist officer shows that he, too, was cognizant of the psychology of honor, and he had a similar intuitive sense of game theory. During a tense moment in the crisis, he offered Kennedy this analysis: "You and I should not now pull on the ends of the rope in which you have tied a knot of war, because the harder you and I pull, the tighter this knot will become. And the time may come when this knot is tied so tight that the person who tied it is no longer capable of untying it, and then the knot will have to be cut." They untied the knot by making mutual concessions. Khrushchev removed his missiles from Cuba, Kennedy removed his from Turkey, and Kennedy promised not to invade Cuba. Nor was the de-escalation purely a stroke of uncanny good luck. Mueller reviewed the history of superpower confrontations during the Cold War and concluded that the sequence was more like climbing a ladder than stepping onto an escalator. Though several times the leaders began a perilous ascent, with each rung they climbed, they became increasingly acrophobic and always sought a way to gingerly step back down. And for all the shoe-pounding bluster of the Soviet Union during the Cold War, its leadership spared the world another cataclysm when Mikhail Gorbachev allowed the Soviet bloc, and then the Soviet Union itself, to go out of existence. What the historian Timothy Garden Ash has called a breathtaking renunciation of the use of force and a luminous example of the importance of the individual in history. This last remark reminds us that the historical contingency works both ways. There are parallel universes in which the Archduke's driver didn't make a wrong turn in Sarajevo, or in which a policeman aimed differently during the beer hall putsch, and history unfolded with one or two fewer world wars. There are other parallel universes in which an American president listened to his Joint Chiefs of Staff and invaded Cuba, or in which a Soviet leader responded to the breach of the Berlin Wall by calling out the tanks, and history unfolded with one or two more. But given the changing odds set by the prevailing ideas and norms, it is not surprising that in our universe it was the first half of the 20th century that was shaped by a Princip and a Hitler, and the second half by a Kennedy, a Khrushchev, and a Gorbachev. Yet another historic upheaval in the landscape of 20th century values was a resistance by the populations of democratic nations to their leaders' plans for war. The late 1950s and early 1960s saw mass demonstrations to ban the bomb, whose legacy includes the trident and circle peace symbol co-opted by other anti-war movements. By the late 1960s, the United States was torn apart by protests against the Vietnam War. Anti-war convictions were no longer confined to sentimental aunts of both sexes, and the idealists who went about in sandals and beards were no longer cranks, but a significant proportion of the generation that reached adulthood in the 1960s. Unlike the major artworks deploring World War I, which appeared more than a decade after it was over, popular art in the 1960s condemned the nuclear arms race and the Vietnam War in real time. Anti-war advocacy was woven into primetime television programs, such as the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour and MASH, and many popular films. Catch-22, Failsafe, Dr. Strangelove, Hearts and Minds, FTA, How I Won the War, Johnny Got His Gun, King of Hearts, MASH, Oh, What a Lovely War, Slaughterhouse-Five, and many songs. Alice's Restaurant, Blowin' in the Wind, Cruel War, Eve of Destruction, Feel Like I'm Fixin' to Die, Rag, Give Peace a Chance, Happy Christmas, War is Over, I Ain't Marchin' Anymore, If I Had a Hammer, Imagine, It's a Hard Rain's a-gonna Fall, Last Night I Had the Strangest Dream, Machine Gun, Masters of War, Sky Pilot, 3500, Turn, 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 Universal Soldier, What's Going On, With God on Our Side, War, What Is It Good For, Waist Deep in the Big Muddy, Where Have All the Flowers Gone? As in the 1700s and the 1930s, artists did not just preach about war to make it seem immoral, but satirized it to make it seem ridiculous. During the 1969 Woodstock concert, Country Joe and the Fish sang the jaunty Feel Like I'm Fixin' to Die, Rag, whose chorus was, And it's one, two, three, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven, open up the pearly gates. There ain't no time to wonder why, whoopee, we're all gonna die. In his 1967 monologue, Alice's Restaurant, Arlo Guthrie told of being drafted and sent to an army psychiatrist at the Induction Center in New York. And I went up there, I said, Shrink, I want to kill. I mean, I wanna kill. Kill. I wanna see blood and gore and guts and veins in my teeth. Eat dead, burnt bodies. I mean, kill. 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 And I started jumping up and down, yelling, Kill. Kill. And he started jumping up and down with me. And we was both jumping up and down, yelling, Kill! Kill! And the sergeant came over, pinned a medal on me, sent me down the hall, said, You're our boy. It's easy to dismiss this cultural moment as baby boomer nostalgia. As Tom Lehrer satirized it, they won all the battles, but we had the good songs. But in a sense, we did win the battles. In the wake of nationwide protests, Lyndon Johnson shocked the country by not seeking his party's nomination in the 1968 presidential election. Though a reaction against the increasingly unruly protests helped elect Richard Nixon in 1968, Nixon shifted the country's war plans from a military victory to a face-saving withdrawal, though not before another 20,000 Americans and a million Vietnamese had died in the fighting. After a 1973 ceasefire, American troops were withdrawn, and Congress effectively ended the war by prohibiting additional intervention and cutting off funding for the South Vietnamese government. The United States was then said to have fallen into a Vietnam syndrome, in which it shied away from military engagement. By the 1980s, it had recovered well enough to fight several small wars and to support anti-communist forces in several proxy wars. But clearly, its military policy would never be the same. The phenomenon called casualty dread, war aversion, and the Dover Doctrine, the imperative to minimize flag-draped coffins returning to Dover Air Force Base, reminded even the more hawkish presidents that the country would not tolerate casualty-intensive military adventures. By the 1990s, the only politically acceptable American wars were surgical routes achieved with remote control technology. They could no longer be wars of attrition that ground up soldiers by the tens of thousands, nor aerial holocausts visited on foreign civilians as in Dresden, Hiroshima, and North Vietnam. The change is palpable within the American military itself. Military leaders at all levels have become aware that gratuitous killing is a public relations disaster at home and counterproductive abroad, alienating allies and emboldening enemies. The Marine Corps has instituted a martial arts program in which leathernecks are indoctrinated in a new code of honor, the ethical Marine warrior. The catechism is, "The ethical warrior is a protector of life. Whose life? Self and others. Which others? All others." The code is instilled with empathy-expanding allegories such as the hunting story, recounted by Robert Humphrey, a retired officer whose martial bona fides were impeccable, having commanded a rifle platoon on Iwo Jima in World War II. In this story, an American military unit is serving in a poor Asian country, and one day, members of the unit go boar hunting as a diversion. They took a truck from the motor pool and headed out to the boondocks, stopping at a village to lure some local men to beat the bush and act as guides. This village was very poor. The huts were made of mud and there was no electricity or running water. The streets were unpaved dirt and the whole village smelled. Flies abounded. The men looked surly and wore dirty clothes. The women covered their faces and the children had runny noses and were dressed in rags. It wasn't long before one American in the truck said, "This place stinks." Another said, "These people live just like animals." Finally, a young Air Force man said, "Yeah, they got nothing to live for. They may as well be dead." What could you say? It seemed true enough. But just then, an old sergeant in the truck spoke up. He was the quiet type who never said much. In fact, except for his uniform, he kind of reminded you of one of the tough men in the village. He looked at the young airman and said, "You think they got nothing to live for, do you? Well, if you are so sure, why don't you just take my knife, jump down off the back of this truck, and go try to kill one of them?" There was dead silence in the truck. The sergeant went on to say, "I don't know either why they value their lives so much. Maybe it's those snotty-nosed kids or the women in the pantaloons. But whatever it is, they care about their lives and the lives of their loved ones, same as we Americans do. And if we don't stop talking bad about them, they will kick us out of this country." A soldier asked him what we Americans, with all our wealth, could do to prove our respect for the peasants' human equality, despite their destitution. The sergeant answered easily, "You got to be brave enough to jump off the back of this truck, knee-deep in the mud and sheep dung. You got to have the courage to walk through this village with a smile on your face. And when you see the smelliest, scariest-looking peasant, you got to be able to look him in the face and let him know, just with your eyes, that you know he is a man who hurts like you do, and hopes like you do, and wants for his kids just like we all do. It is that way, or we lose." The code of the ethical warrior, even as an aspiration, shows that the American armed forces have come a long way from a time when its soldiers referred to Vietnamese peasants as gooks, slopes, and slants, and when the military was slow to investigate atrocities against civilians, such as the massacre at My Lai. As former Marine Captain Jack Hoban, who helped to implement the Ethical Warrior program, wrote to me, "When I first joined the Marines in the 1970s, it was kill, kill, kill. The probability that there would have been an honor code that trained Marines to be protectors of all others, including the enemy, if possible, would have been 0%. To be sure, the American-led wars in Afghanistan and Iraq in the first decade of the 21st century showed that the country is far from reluctant to go to war. But even they are nothing like the wars of the past. In both conflicts, the interstate war phase was quick and, by historical standards, low in battle deaths. Most of the deaths in Iraq were caused by intercommunal violence and the anarchy that followed, and by 2008, the toll of 4,000 American deaths, compare Vietnam's 58,000, helped elect a president who, within 2 years, brought the country's combat mission to an end. In Afghanistan, the U.S. Air Force followed a set of humanitarian protocols during the height of the anti-Taliban bombing campaign in 2008 that Human Rights Watch praised for its very good record of minimizing harm to civilians. The political scientist Joshua Goldstein, in a discussion of how policies of smart targeting had massively reduced civilian deaths in Kosovo and in both Iraq wars, comments on the use of armed drones against Taliban and Al-Qaeda targets in Afghanistan and Pakistan in 2009. Where an army previously would have blasted its way into the militants' hideouts, killing and displacing civilians by the tens of thousands as it went, and then ultimately reducing whole towns and villages to rubble with inaccurate artillery and aerial bombing in order to get at a few enemy fighters. Now a drone flies in and lets fly a single missile against a single house where militants are gathered. Yes, sometimes such attacks hit the wrong house, but by any historical comparison, the rate of civilian deaths has fallen dramatically. So far has this trend come, and so much do we take it for granted, that a single errant missile that killed 10 civilians in Afghanistan was front-page news in February 2010. This event, a terrible tragedy in itself, nonetheless was an exception to a low overall rate of harm to civilians in the middle of a major military offensive, one of the largest in 8 years of war. Yet these 10 deaths brought the U.S. military commander in Afghanistan to offer a profuse apology to the president of Afghanistan and the world news media to play up the event as a major development in the offensive. The point is not that killing 10 civilians is okay, but rather that in any previous war, even a few years ago, this kind of civilian death would barely have caused a ripple of attention. Civilian deaths, in sizable numbers, used to be universally considered a necessary and inevitable, if perhaps unfortunate, byproduct of war. That we are entering an era when these assumptions no longer apply is good news indeed. Goldstein's assessment was confirmed in 2011 when Science magazine reported data from WikiLeaks documents and from a previously classified civilian casualty database of the American-led military coalition. The documents revealed that around 5,300 civilians had been killed in Afghanistan from 2004 through 2010, the majority, around 80%, by Taliban insurgents rather than coalition forces. Even if the estimate is doubled, it would represent an extraordinarily low number of civilian deaths for a major military operation. In the Vietnam War, by comparison, at least 800,000 civilians died in battle. As big as the change in American attitudes toward war has been, the change in Europe is beyond recognition. As the foreign policy analyst Robert Kagan puts it, "Americans are from Mars. Europeans are from Venus." In February 2003, mass demonstrations in European cities protested the impending American-led invasion of Iraq, drawing 1 million people each in London, Barcelona, and Rome, and more than 500,000 in Madrid and Berlin. In London, the signs read, No blood for oil. Stop mad cowboy disease. America, the real rogue state. Make tea, not war. Down with this sort of thing. And simply, no. Germany and France conspicuously refused to join the United States and Britain, and Spain pulled out soon afterward. Even the war in Afghanistan, which aroused less opposition in Europe, is being fought mainly by American soldiers. Not only do they make up more than half of the 44-nation NATO military operation, but the Continental Forces have acquired a certain reputation when it comes to martial virtues. A Canadian Armed Forces captain wrote to me from Kabul in 2003. During this morning's Kalashnikov concerto, I was waiting for the tower guards in our camp to open fire. I think they were asleep. That's par for the course. Our towers are manned by the Bundeswehr, and they haven't been doing a good job when they're actually there. I qualified that last comment because the Germans have already abandoned the towers several times. The first time was when we got hit by rockets. The remaining instances had something to do with it being cold in the towers. A German lieutenant with whom I spoke about this lack of honor and basic soldier etiquette replied that it was Canada's responsibility to provide heaters for the towers. I snapped back by mentioning that it was Germany's responsibility to provide warm clothing to its soldiers. I was tempted to mention something about Kabul not being Stalingrad, but I held my tongue. The German army of today is not what it once was. Or, as I've heard mentioned here several times, this ain't the Wehrmacht. Given the history of our people, I can make the argument that that's a very good thing indeed. However, since my safety now rests upon the vigilance of the Herren Folk's progeny, I'm slightly concerned, to say the least. In a book titled, Where Have All the Soldiers Gone? The Transformation of Modern Europe, and in Britain, The Monopoly on Violence, Why Europeans Hate Going to War, the historian James Sheehan argues that Europeans have changed their very conception of the state. It is no longer the proprietor of a military force that enhances the grandeur and security of the nation, but a provisioner of social security and material well-being. Nonetheless, for all the differences between the American mad cowboys and the European surrender monkeys, the parallel movement of their political culture away from war over the past six decades is more historically significant than their remaining differences. Is the long peace a nuclear peace? What went right? How is it that, in defiance of experts, doomsday clocks, and centuries of European history, World War III never happened? What allowed distinguished military historians to use giddy phrases like a change of spectacular proportions, the most striking discontinuity in the history of warfare, and nothing like this in history? To many people, the answer is obvious. The bomb. War had become too dangerous to contemplate, and leaders were scared straight. The balance of nuclear terror deterred them from starting a war that would escalate to a Holocaust and put an end to civilization, if not human life itself. As Winston Churchill said in his last major speech to Parliament, "It may well be that we shall, by a process of sublime irony, have reached a stage in this story where safety will be the sturdy child of terror, and survival the twin brother of annihilation." In the same vein, the foreign policy analyst Kenneth Waltz has suggested that we thank our nuclear blessings, and Elspeth Rostow proposed that the nuclear bomb be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Let's hope not. If the long peace were a nuclear peace, it would be a fool's paradise, because an accident, a miscommunication, or an Air Force general obsessed with precious bodily fluids could set off an apocalypse. Thankfully, a closer look suggests that the threat of nuclear annihilation deserves little credit for the long peace. For one thing, weapons of mass destruction had never braked the march to war before. The benefactor of the Nobel Peace Prize wrote in the 1860s, that his invention of dynamite would sooner lead to peace than 1,000 world conventions, since as soon as men will find that in one instant whole armies can be utterly destroyed, they will surely abide in golden peace. Similar predictions have been made about submarines, artillery, smokeless powder, and the machine gun. The 1930s saw a widespread fear that poison gas dropped from airplanes could bring an end to civilization and human life, yet that dread did not come close to ending war either. As Luard puts it, "There is little evidence in history that the existence of supremely destructive weapons alone is capable of deterring war. If the development of bacteriological weapons, poison gas, nerve gases, and other chemical armaments did not deter war in 1939, it is not easy to see why nuclear weapons should do so now." Also, the theory of the nuclear peace cannot explain why countries without nuclear weapons also forbore war. Why, for example, the 1995 squabble over fishing rights between Canada and Spain, or the 1997 dispute between Hungary and Slovakia over damming the Danube, never escalated into war, as crises involving European countries had so often done in the past. During the long peace, leaders of developed countries never had to calculate which of their counterparts they could get away with attacking. Yes for Germany and Italy, no for Britain and France, because they never contemplated a military attack in the first place. Nor were they deterred by nuclear godparents. It wasn't as if the United States had to threaten Canada and Spain with a nuclear spanking if they got too obstreperous in their dispute over flatfish. As for the superpowers themselves, Mueller points to a simpler explanation for why they avoided fighting each other. They were deterred plenty by the prospect of a conventional war. World War II showed that assembly lines could mass-produce tanks, artillery, and bombers that were capable of killing tens of millions of people and reducing cities to rubble. This was especially obvious in the Soviet Union, which had suffered the greatest losses in the war. It's unlikely that the marginal difference between the unthinkable damage that would be caused by a nuclear war and the thinkable, but still staggering damage that would be caused by a conventional war was the main thing that kept the great powers from fighting. Finally, the nuclear peace theory cannot explain why the wars that did take place often had a non-nuclear force provoking or failing to surrender to a nuclear one. Exactly the matchup that the nuclear threat ought to have deterred. North Korea, North Vietnam, Iran, Iraq, Panama, and Yugoslavia defied the United States. Afghan and Chechen insurgents defied the Soviet Union. Egypt defied Britain and France. Egypt and Syria defied Israel. Vietnam defied China. And Argentina defied the United Kingdom. For that matter, the Soviet Union established its stranglehold on Eastern Europe during just those years, 1945 through 49, when the United States had nuclear weapons and it did not. The countries that goaded their nuclear superiors were not suicidal. They correctly anticipated that for anything but an existential danger, the implicit threat of a nuclear response was a bluff. The Argentinian junta ordered the invasion of the Falkland Islands in full confidence that Britain would not retaliate by reducing Buenos Aires to a radioactive crater. Nor could Israel have credibly threatened the amassed Egyptian armies in 1967 or 1973, to say nothing of Cairo. Schelling and the political scientist Nina Tannenwald have each written of a nuclear taboo, a shared perception that nuclear weapons fall into a uniquely dreadful category. The use of a single tactical nuclear weapon, even one comparable in damage to conventional weaponry, would be seen as a breach in history, a passage into a new world with unimaginable consequences. The obloquy has attached itself to every form of nuclear detonation. The neutron bomb, a weapon that would cause minimal blast damage but would kill soldiers with a transient burst of radiation, fell deadborn from the military lab because of universal loathing, even though, as the political scientist Stanley Hoffman pointed out, it satisfied the moral philosopher's requirements for waging a just war. The half-crazed Atoms for Peace schemes of the 1950s and 1960s, in which nuclear explosions would be harnessed to dig canals, excavate harbors, or propel rockets into space, are now the stuff of incredulous reminiscences of a benighted age. To be sure, the non-U